to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Susan Henderson's The Flicker of Old Dreams is about the death of a small town in central Montana as told by Mary Crampton, an embalmer in her father's mortuary.
The novel was the winner of the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Best Contemporary Western Novel, Montana Book Award Honor Book, and is the finalist for the High Plains Book Award for Fiction.
Susan Henderson is a 5-time Pushcart nominee and the recipient of an Academy of American Poets Award.
Welcome to the studio, Susan. We're so thrilled to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I grew up in Montana, and reading this book, I was really familiar with small town politics and how people cling to not wanting to have change and fighting change. You grew up or were born in Montana, right? Tell us about your background.
So my my extended family comes from all parts of Montana, from Missoula to Bozeman to Two Dot to Roundup to Winnet. So we spent a lot of time in Montana, but then my dad was the only one who left Montana. So he raised us in D.C. So I feel like I've long lived this having a foot in two very different worlds. And so that was sort of the fun of this novel, was I wanted to get at this sense of this division in America, this idea that we live in two different Americas right now. And I wanted to see if there was a way to get them to speak to each other.
Yeah, there's a longing in the main character for something that she doesn't even know necessarily exists, mm-hmm. and getting exposed to another world. And I mean, the novel's such a wonderful sense of place. You definitely explore the rural sense of these smaller Montana communities. And the fictional town, Petroleum, set in central Montana, I'm curious, what kind of research you did to paint this place. Obviously, you've got ties to Montana. Mm-hmm. How did Petroleum come about for you?
So Petroleum is very much based on the town of Winnet, where my father grew up and where my grandparents lived, and we used to visit in the summers with all the cousins. And Winnet is a town of about 180 people, although you would never know it was that big because you never see more than, five at a time. And so I had known Winnet for a long time, but I decided when I got the idea for the book that I sort of wanted to tackle the division and the rage of our times, but I did not want to write about politics.
Sure.
I thought, I'm going to go back to this place and just listen and see if a story emerges from it. So I went back for a month, and I lived in the little motel that's there. And I just kind of walked around and listened and talked to everybody who would talk to me and said yes to every invitation for a ride or for dinner or for a book club or calf tagging. I just said yes to everything. And I just tried to kind of get a feel for being there.
The main character, Mary, says, "We all have to make an extra effort during these tough times. Adding a little water to the milk, a little vegetable oil to the gasoline, everybody gets by as they can." I think that is so true of poverty, mm-hmm. and also true of rural America. Did you experience that?
Yeah, definitely with my family when I visited them and when they talked about things. And even when my dad left Montana and started making a lot of money in his job, he still lived like a Winnet stoic. So some of the things is like we would have the heat turned way, 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 way down, put on a sweater, get the hot water bottle if you're cold, putting tinfoil over the windows to keep it insulated. And to keep yourself feeling claustrophobic. And then a classic thing from my family, there was a member of my family, won't name him, who accidentally cut into a main artery in his hand. And everyone in my family, there's two qualities they all have in common, is they don't complain, and they just do what they need to do, and then they get back to work. So he had cut into this artery in his hands, going everywhere, walks down to the basement, got some fishing line, sewed it up himself without even squinting, and then went back to work. And then it was like, this is just kind of classic with just the tough stock that comes from this place.
Mm-hmm. Wow, a lot of grit. And you capture that in the novel. I think about like peering from behind the tinfoil to see what the neighbors are doing, the fishing line, sewing up your own stitches.
Yeah.
You definitely have to have that kind of rough stock in a place like this. And the novel does open with a tragedy that's really familiar in agricultural communities. How much of this, you know, was based on a true story? You talk about petroleum being very informed by the community. What about this, these tragedies or these specific events in the novel?
So as I was talking to people and just kind of knowing my dad and my uncles, you know, over the years, you hear that tragedy is just kind of a part of, you know, these terrible accidents that happen on ranches are just sort of a part of the community. So there was not a this particular accident at that particular grain elevator, but I did talk to everyone while I was there. I was like, can you show me inside this grain elevator? Can you tell me how it runs? How did it sound? Who worked there? What did they do? And then the more I looked into the grain elevators, I started researching, you know, they have some in Canada and in the plains areas, and they tended to have the same accidents at all the grain elevators that had tragedies. They were either a fire or they were drowning in grain. And then they tended to have these underage workers. So I just sort of incorporated that into the story.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating.
It's so sad to know how common that has been. Mm-hmm. There's the story of the boy captured in the grain elevator, or there's a child thrown from a tractor.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain agricultural tragedies. But in this case, it's a little unusual because the boy that is sort of blamed for it is mm-hmm. really not to blame for it. He's in a situation where things happen that he has no control over, but the town turns on him.
Mm-hmm. So I took sort of the real things about Winnet, and then I added my imagination, and I added this kind of current political environment minus the politics. So I felt like part of what we're living through right now is there's such rage and tribalism, and a lot of times it's not based in fact at all. It's just this kind of entrenched, like you're angry at something about your situation and then you look for a scapegoat. And so I wanted to have rage in the story that was just kind of stuck and immovable, and rage that was not tied to anything that was logical. It was passed down. And so I was playing with that and then playing like, what do we do with this rage? And Mary is someone who in the story, your first question was about change versus people mm-hmm. who want change versus people who fear change. And so I thought, if you have an environment where some people are really feeling rage at the loss of the work and the lifestyle that created their identity, and then you have other people that never fit into that world, those were not things that they dreamed of becoming. They don't love fishing. They do. And so what are those people who are other in these communities, whether it's an academic or an artist or just all the ways that we're other in the world? And what did these two groups need to say to each other?
Mary is such a fascinating character because she gets to explore the residents of this town after they're deceased. And she lives this outside life that you're talking about, but yet she has such intimacy mm-hmm. with these characters, and we get to know them through their dead bodies. It's a really, really excellent character trait to get to explore. Gosh, how much did you learn about the work of a mortician doing this?
A lot. So I got the idea to have a mortician in the book once I came back from my research trip, and I started looking through the pictures that I had taken on the trip, and I thought, oh my God, I've been watching something in the process of dying. Who's the best person to tell this story? And as soon as I thought of a mortician, it was like, that's it. So then I suddenly had to learn everything. So I started with books about death and books about, you know, like Mary Roach's Stiff, which is such a good book. It's a book of essays. I got an encyclopedia of the dead. And so it was sort of like everything, like how fast do things rot? What happens to the skin 1 hour after death versus 3 days after death? So I read all of those things. And then I started reading about surgeons, because I wanted to just kind of have a fluency with talking about the body and what is my hand feeling as I go inside. And so I sort of started there. And then I moved into taking online classes to be a mortician, just kind of auditing them just to see, you know, how would I get certified in this? And that led me to this network of morticians. And then the best was meeting the people that had grown up in funeral homes and talking to them. So I'm talking to all these people. And then the very last group of people I started talking to were hospice workers, because the more I learned about morticians, I started getting, it got sort of too creepy.
Sure, and maybe really specific on the process as opposed to the human interest parts that you bring in so well.
Right, in terms of the human being that's dying or has just passed or the family that's left behind, and it was the hospice care workers that sort of brought Mary to life.
Well, and certainly Mary's father, who runs the funeral home, is like everyone's friend. I mean, he is the soft touch in the community, and he's the warm character that somehow Mary can't be. So she becomes very close to the bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, how interesting that he's a businessman too, right? Yeah. So his job is to have the face of the business and to be courting, so to speak, his next customers, even though he can't predict it.
I was just so surprised at reading about death and knowing how beautiful and lyrical your work is and how you can sort of talk about that. I wondered if you would read a section from the book.
Yes. Okay, so this is a section where it's the first time the reader goes to work with Mary. So they're just coming down the stairs. They, as in the reader, they're just coming down the stairs into the basement where she does her embalming, and she has a guest waiting for her. The dead come to me vulnerable, sharing their stories and secrets. Here is my scar. Touch it. Here is the roll of fat I always hid under that big sweater, and now you see. This is the person I've kept private, afraid of what people would think. Here I am, all of me, scarred, flabby, covered in bed sores. Please be kind. When a body comes to our funeral home, it comes draped in a white sheet. The sheets begin clean, but soon they carry the essence of the one who died. First in silhouette, the contour of the nose, a valley or mountain at the stomach, the feet turned slightly in or out, the bumps of shoulders, breasts, chin. Before I move the sheet aside, I study this landscape. At first glance, it is like a field covered in fresh snow. Then the details become more visible. Just as a field of snow, upon closer inspection, shows signs of the life that has tramped through it, so will the sheet show something beyond its surface. There are smears and drips, a spot of blood where the IV was removed, a stain from loose bowels not thoroughly wiped, the sticky smear of saliva, the gray shadow of one final sweat. I pull the sheet back and welcome Mr. Mosley to the bright white silence of my workroom, take his cold hand and hold it gently in my own. His face, neck, and hands are red and toughened from years of working in sun and cold and wind. The rest of him is quite pale, soft. I don't often get to know my neighbors until we meet this way. And that is the case with Mr. Mosley. His wrecked body lies on the stainless steel table, a faucet near his head, a drain near his feet, and there is much to do, but first this, his hand. Here is the man, nothing to hide behind, no sheet or uniform or name tag. This is the man without his possessions, with chores left undone, with mistakes he can't make right, with nothing more he can prove. I'm right here, I tell him. It is what I have longed for my whole life. Perhaps everyone longs for this, just to be and to have someone stay near. He does not complain that my hands are clammy. There is no pressure to be charming or clever. We are simply here together in this quiet.
Oh, I just love that detail about holding the hand and something that she does with all the people that come into her basement.
And then a human enters the picture when this...
A live one.
A live human comes
in. We've got
in,
a live one here.
When this young boy who was sort of dishonored as a boy and left the town comes back to Petroleum to bury his mother. And Mary all of a sudden is having to deal with this boy and come out of her shell and deal with humans.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how that evolved, because she doesn't want to, really.
No. So she's someone who's never quite fit into this town. She doesn't have the same interests and the same skills as the people around her. So she's always been kind of on the outside. But so what the way she had handled it in the past is she's just kind of dialed down her opinions, her voice, her dreams. And then someone comes from the outside world that sort of awakens something that she had let, you know, nearly die inside of her. And I don't think she would normally have the courage to stand up to this, except that the unfairness hits her profession. And it's the one area where she has professional and ethical standards, and now she can actually speak up in a professional way.
Because it crosses the line.
It crosses that line.
The townspeople can be cruel or indifferent, but at some point she says no.
Yeah.
Well, and Susan, talking about aligning this with the current climate that we're in, with a lot of I don't even know how to put it, but there's so much uncomfortableness and disagreement and a lot of one-sided ideas about how we should relate to one another. It's interesting to hear that play out through this fiction novel, and you've done a really good job because it didn't immediately jump out to me, but without, you know, being a spoiler, there's a lot that this character goes through and changes in the course of her life, and the end is a really beautiful resolution for her.
Yeah, I think when, if I had come right out and talked about it, we all have our camps that we go into and then we can't hear each other. And I felt like I wanted to show respect and compassion for the people in this town that are chronically unemployed and underemployed, and the grit and the just the knowledge base that they bring to this job, and the sorrow of seeing this lifestyle disappear that has been their entire identity.
Sure, and the pride there too.
Yeah, and then when you're, you know, and it was more my feeling when I went to this town, when you feel like the other, I wanted to see, you know, maybe there's a way to move this a little bit, to hear and respect each other's positions at least a little bit.
It reminds me of the coal industry, that people cling to the fact that they were coal miners, and they're very proud of that. In this case, this is an ag community that says we're wheat farmers, regardless of the reality of the situation, and yet they cling to that so desperately.
Yeah.
Well, and I'd like to break down that idea that people cling, because we've heard this before used around rural lifestyles, is that we're clinging to an idea, we're clinging to our guns, but there's an inability to do it a different way. This is absolutely the way that you survive in a town like this, and there aren't other options. And so it is very curious to think about the rural nature of America, and maybe we're the outsiders when we describe their only options is desperation.
I remember when I was visiting this town and I went on this long ride with a rancher, and they brought up the idea of, they said someone came into the community and wanted to teach these ranchers who were just really struggling to hold on to their ranches and make money, and they had already fired everyone they could, so it was down to the family members, and everyone was working way harder than they could maintain, and people were getting physically sick. And he said someone came to the community and was like, we could teach you how to be a computer programmer. And they just felt like, that's not me, that's not who I want to be. And And it was really powerful to hear it from the source, because I know if someone told me to become, you know, a rancher and it's not in my bones, if someone took away the thing that was really passionate for me, and you just realize, like, maybe this is the way things will inevitably move in and are already in process. But to just feel compassion and respect for the grief.
Yeah, and I'm curious what makes Mary perhaps break from that tradition in the novel and move from dreaming of a better life to really pursuing it.
We cheer for Mary because even though she has a job, she doesn't have a life.
Yeah, yeah. And it's this this person coming to town that I was trying to think, how can I get her to come out of this basement? Because she really is more comfortable with the dead than the living. And I thought, how can I force her out of the basement and into the living world where she's super uncomfortable and not very skilled and have to relate and have to learn to have her voice, her own voice.
Compassion and empathy comes across in her storyline. And and there's a lot of humanizing elements here. I think there's a lot to take away from how we interact in the real world.
Yeah.
So speaking of support, let's get to your life, which I think is very interesting because you have an organization called Lit Park in New York. Tell us a little bit about the support network that you've sort of set up for other writers.
So Lit Park is a safe haven for writers because writers, whether it's just the intimidating blank page or you think you're writing a novel and all you have are three very bad chapters, all the things, like, or you feel very, very passionate about a particular topic or setting or character, and you know you want to write a book, but you don't know how to get started, or you have some beautiful piece of something that you made and no one will buy it. So it's just a place to take all the weary, demoralized writers and give practical advice about how to do this work and how to keep healthy in this work and how to take some shortcuts. I find if you stand in line and you're good, you know, if you're a good girl, you don't get to the front of the line, you know, fast enough. So it's just kind of that place because I feel like a supportive community is everything for a writer.
Boy, we could dedicate a whole other program to that. I'm like, tell me more. How do I sign up? Demoralized writer over here. Life's hard.
I could hear Anna's like. Anyway, it's very much a part of what I think we try to do in Billings too, whether it's art or music, is finding support for people to make it to that next step.
Yeah, and the people who know are always my two rock stars of the world, librarians and indie booksellers. Those are always the people that know where the networks are, where the readings are, where the workshops are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And anyone who's operating, you know, sort of an independent off the grid, like I think about our local record stores that, you know, always know where the, you know, the next local release is coming out or any of those quirky, funky little art gallery hole in the walls. I mean, those are the people with the tap into the community. And I love that, like, for your novel, too, you went back to Winnett and you tapped into that place and you got it directly from, you know, the horse's mouth, so to speak. That's a really beautiful way to do it.
Have people in Winnett responded to your book?
People, so I got a lot of fan mail from the town of Lewistown, which is close to Winnett. And a lot of people are kind of quietly, they didn't realize it was about politics, but the notes I get are like, thank you. I thought I was the only one privately feeling this kind of the knot in my stomach that I love this community and I'm a part of this community. And also I feel that I've had to be dialed down. So I've heard from them. I was just in Winnett for the 100th high school reunion. I went with my dad, class of 56. And we didn't talk about books at all. We were just talking about people's lives and people's crops, and I kind of like that better.
there's some parallels here to Joe Wilkins' work. We had him on the program a little bit ago, and the same kind of idea of protagonist in a rural part of Montana that just doesn't quite fit in, and also there's poetic elements to Joe's writing, and I'm curious what the poet in you did for this fiction work.
So I'm a crazy, I'm just like a frantic reader. I'm always looking for a book that I love enough to read out loud because I just love the clack of words. I love when the language hurries up, and so then you start to, I just love all the ways that people play with words. So I read a lot of stuff that not related to the West, but Ocean Byung, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, beautiful, beautiful book of poetry. My two favorite writers, Toni Morrison and James Baldwin, I read a lot of them. Kent Harif, with all of his Colorado stories. Just the lyrical work. I think if you just read a lot, I like to read poetry and then write prose because it just kind of gets in your ear, just the importance of language, the importance of the actual sentence.
Yeah, it absolutely comes through in your work.
People have compared it to, and I love this, Edith Wharton.
Yeah.
Because your work is not floral, but it flows beautifully. And there are so many contemporary writers that I think have too many words.
Oh, and here's a great quote, Corby, that you pulled out for us. Author Helen Simonson said, "Like the wind scours paint from an old grain silo, Susan Henderson's writing scours away all the pretend niceness of a small town life in Montana to reveal the frayed and patched nature of humanity. Nobility, ragged resilience, and hope compete with small-minded ignorance." And I think there's a cleanliness to your writing that really allowed that storyline to come out because there's not a heavy-handed editorialization.
Or political.
Of what's going on here, right. And so that storyline really does come through very boldly, but in a way that didn't feel forced.
Yeah, I feel like the words are sort of, the part of Winnet that got passed down to me is I love spare writing down to the bone, and I try never to say how someone's feeling. I just show what's actually happening in the body. What are they doing with their hands? The way that you used to bond with the male, you know, side of my family was like you'd build a fence together. And that said everything it could about the relationship. And so I'm a big believer in kind of spare, not too adjective-y sentences.
Well, I would encourage all of our listeners to get a copy of The Flicker of Old Dreams by Sue Henderson. It is nominated for the High Plains Book Award in Fiction, and it is a delightful story.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.